transmitting sound. Download complete. Now launching audio stream. The Kelly Alexander Show.
We kick things off with our dietitian, Kim Airy, talking about the importance of children's nutrition. It's very important your kids are powering their bodies with not only the right foods, but the right amounts. Kim has all the information to help your child get a head start on their nutritional track. We then chat with career counselor Sharon Armstrong about how to conduct yourself in job interviews and to know what questions you should and should not answer. Finally, Dr. Giacomo Bono joins us to talk about how being grateful can help you lead a much more fulfilling life where you look at the glass half full instead of half empty.
Capture your need for sound.
Families are so busy these days, running from daycare to soccer practice to music lessons. Making sure that your child's nutritional needs are met is also increasingly more difficult with so many added preservatives in foods. But could parents be doing more for their kids? Dietitian Kim Airy joins us to discuss some of the easy ways parents can improve their child's nutrition. Kim, thanks for joining us on the Kelly Alexander Show.
Oh, it's my pleasure to be here.
Nutrition is so important, you know, for a child's growth and eating habits and basically how they're going to carry themselves for the rest of their lives. What do you think is the number one most important thing that parents should be doing?
I guess the number one most important thing that parents should be doing is setting the example that eating well is a priority. If our kids get the message for us that eating is something we do while we're watching TV or while we're driving or while we're watching a soccer game and we never have time for meals, then they're getting the message that meals are not that important. And really, we have to remember that we have to nourish our bodies, and nourishing our bodies and our minds starts with really good, healthy food. And so we have to take the time to eat it. Now, that means maybe family meals, and we know family meals have a great impact on the whole family and the children.
Now, when it comes to eating habits, should children be eating regular meals or should they be eating smaller portions more regularly throughout the day?
Well, little children, and it depends on the age of your kids. Small children have small tummies, so they can't eat large amounts. So you're going to be wanting to give them small portions and probably a little more often. So it's important for them to have snacks because they also need a lot of energy. For they're doing a lot more running around, it takes a lot of energy to grow. So they do need quite a bit of energy. And when we're talking about small portions, if you want to look at Canada's food guide, they actually suggest portion sizes for children.
Okay,
and
that's good.
It's interesting because the portion sizes they suggest for the children are almost half of what you would suggest for an adult.
Wow. Now, I wanted to ask you just on the note of them needing to eat more regularly or that it's a better plan, I guess, to do that. How do you manage that with them being at school? Because I remember when I was at school, like, we were not allowed to have food out except at recess and lunch.
Well, and so theoretically, how the schedules are set up nowadays is, you know, you have your breakfast and you may have a morning recess or an early lunch, depending on how the school works. And then you have either you finish early enough in the afternoon that snack time would coincide with the end of class, or you have lunch at the or you have a late lunch and you have a recess. So all of those options are in there. I think it's available. The issue is we have to be able to make sure that we're sending appropriate food to the children and that the children don't have a lot of choice, because sometimes we send the appropriate food and then they go to the hot dog stand down the road. That's not
right.
Really what we want them to do, right? So we have to set it up that they're going to make those choices. And for instance, they just did some research and they found that when you actually offer fruits and vegetables to kids in the cafeterias and you're not offering the other foods, they will choose the fruits and vegetables and their intake will go up.
Wow, that's amazing. Now, I wanted to ask you about breakfast because, you know, so many adults skip breakfast, and I'm assuming that this is a negative influence on the children if they don't see mommy and daddy, you know, eating properly in the morning.
Again, we know that kids will model their parents' behaviors. And so if you don't eat breakfast, your children will not eat breakfast. And so it's important for your children to see you eating something for breakfast. It's important for them to see you taking 10 minutes to do that so that they can sit down and take 10 minutes to do that. It's important to try and set up the morning so that breakfast is a priority. We have many, many studies that show that having breakfast in the morning improves test scores. So, I mean, and there's a direct relationship to, did I eat breakfast? How did I do at school? So it's really important to do that, just like it's really important for them to have a good lunch.
What's your thought processes on how parents behave around stimulants like coffee or tea? Because I have so many friends that are addicted to coffee and cannot function without it. And I'm wondering if that's gets passed down to the kids as well, that, you know, when the kid turns 14, 15, they're trying to have coffee at high school.
Well, again, I think that's not something that I can say that I've seen a study directly on, but we do know that they children will take on the patterns of their parents. So if they see a lot of people drinking a lot of tea and coffee, if they see that's the beverage of choice, if they see that, you know, we have to reroute our whole shopping trip to stop at Starbucks or Second Cup or pick a place first, then they're likely to have those behaviors as well.
What can parents do to, I guess, ensure that their child has enough energy to get them through the day? Like, is it really sort of, I don't know, like starting, you know, proper routines?
Well, you want to start with the routine of eating three meals, making sure they have time. I have to say, I've had many an argument with many a hockey dance, whatever, coach that know the classes are during supper time or the practice is during supper time, so my kids won't be there. They'll be at the next one when it's not supper time. We have to make it a priority. We have to show our kids that eating healthy food is a priority. We have to set that example. So we want to make sure that, for example, when we sit down to dinner, we've taken the TV off and we're all concentrating on our meal and we're chatting. We're not just sitting in the family room, you know, watching TV. We want to make sure that Even if the foods are not all home cooked, I mean, I know in my dietitian dreams, I would love everybody to, you know, be cooking at the stove like our grandmothers were, but I know realistically that's not going to happen. So even if you're doing things like you put the crock pot on the night before and the food is ready in the fridge and you just have to reheat it, even if you're doing things like you bought something that's pre-prepared or you prepare one thing and you add a couple of pre-prepared things to it, it's still the principle that we took the time to get the food and we took the time to eat it. And I think that's the first thing we want to get to our kids. Even if you're saying, I'm going to order pizza, fine. Order pizza because we're really tight squeeze, but make sure you serve some veggies and dip with it, or make sure you serve a salad with it so that kids get the idea that there's a little bit of balance to it and I'm not just going to gorge on one food. Have some soup with it. Yes, it's fine to once in a while say we're going to have a treat and we're going to go and we're going to have, you know, I don't know, I have some families that routinely have one night of the week where they go to a fast food restaurant or they get takeout or something. And that's fine. You know, you can do that once a week. My concern is when that happens on a 7-day a week basis, what example are we setting for our kids?
Yeah. And I think that's a really good point to keep in our heads for sure. And on a note about school again, how do you sort of monitor that your kids are, you know, properly ingesting what they need to ingest while they're at school? Because again, that's out of your control in a way.
Well, I think that's the big issue, is that it is out of our control. And so what we have to do is we have to work with our schools to promote that they have healthy foods available. Now, there are policies in the schools in Quebec. Quebec has actually been a leader on the school lunch front. We've had policies in place for many years that ensured that we were making healthier choices. So we can get involved with our schools and kind of step that up when the schools have cafeterias. We make sure that what we send can be healthy. Unfortunately, we don't have a lot of control over what other parents send. So I know many times I sent a really healthy lunch and found out that it had been traded for some stuff I never would have sent. But again, it's to the more the parents are involved, the more that they can see what's going on, and then the more they can help with that. We've also seen in terms of the lunches, the location of the school makes a huge difference. If the location of the school is right near or near enough in walking distance to a fast food restaurant, it doesn't matter what you send, somebody's going to go to the fast food restaurant if they have the money to do it.
Wow. Yeah, that's important. I know that when I was in high school, we didn't have any fast food restaurant near us, but the Dépanneur was near the store. And so I can't tell you the lineups for that kids would go to get chips and, you know, chocolate and all that kind of stuff.
Exactly. So, you know, you can only, I think one thing we have to be aware of as a parent is we can only do what we can do, and we can only pass the messages that we can pass. And, you know, if the Dépanneur is right next to the school, well, we know they're going to be going there for chips. And so then the idea is to say, okay, we know you got your chips at lunchtime, so you're not getting any at home when you get home. Let's have some balance here. It's great. You chose something really sweet for a snack. That's great. So, you know, at home, you're going to have something less sweet so that we have a little bit of balance. And I think one of the things we want to remember to teach our kids is not that you're never allowed to do anything, but that there has to be some balance. So balance means, you know, you get to make choices. If you chose to have a lot of sweet for lunch, then maybe you're not going to get that same choice at supper.
Joining us on the show is our consulting dietitian, Kim Airy. Make sure to check her out on her website, kimairy.com. I have a question about calcium. How much should kids be getting?
Well, in Canada's Food Guide, we're talking about the equivalent of 3 to 4 servings from the milk group. And that can be in the form of milk or soy beverage, or it can be in the form of cheese or yogurt. Just remember that a lot of the cheeses and some of the yogurts don't have vitamin D added to it. So, you know, you're not going to have quite as good absorption of the calcium. But I think what's important to remember with dairy products is that some kids are not getting enough because we say, oh, those little yogurts, you know, those little 50 milliliter yogurts are one portion. And actually one portion of yogurt in Canada's Food Guide is 175 milliliters. So you have a ways to go.
Mm-hmm.
Those are a lot of the small yogurts are smaller portions for the toddlers. But when you hit a 10 or 12 year old, those are not big enough, and you would probably want to double or even triple them.
Wow. Okay, that's important. We are heading into holiday season. We've just come through Halloween. So obviously lots of candy going on. What does it, or what's your opinion when it comes to this stuff? Like whether it's, you know, Halloween, you know, treats or heading into the holiday season where you're getting extra cookies and cakes from grandma. Is it, you know, is there a way to strike a healthy balance where, you know, the kid knows it's okay to have it like once a week or something?
I think it's yes. And I don't even think we need to do the once a week rule. I think once a week might be, especially with the energy requirements kids have, once a week might even be a little restrictive. What we're trying to teach our children is balance, not restriction. And we're trying to teach them how to make choices. So instead of maybe focusing on you're not allowed to have it, maybe focus on you can choose this one or this one. Focus on portion size so you can have, you know, 2 pieces of candy, not gorge yourself on candy. Focus on getting them to eat mindfully. So getting them to sit down when they're going to eat. This was a really big thing when my kids were little, was that they had to sit at the kitchen table whenever they were eating.
That's
and
interesting.
And so if they wanted to eat their candy, that was fine. You could sit all afternoon and eat candy, but you had to sit at the kitchen table and eat the candy. You couldn't be eating the candy or the cookies or the whatever junk you were eating while you were watching TV or while you were doing anything else. Be mindful about it. Understand, are you full? Do you really enjoy it? And, you know, after, well, they didn't actually like it. They'd usually eat the first 10 candies, and then they'd kind of say, no, we had enough.
I think that's really great, the sitting down thing, because you're not then lost in television and not knowing that you've just horked back, like, 15 pieces of Snickers or something.
Exactly. And so, and the fact that we got them to say, no, this is enjoyable. Let's sit down and have our candy together. Let's make it into something really enjoyable. It was much more satisfying than hiding to eat your candy because they knew, look, you know, we're putting it away, but, you know, you'll have some more tomorrow if you want. and give them the choice. Do you want some today? And a lot of days they would actually say no because they knew they had the choice. They can't. It's not like I was taking it away after a month. It's not like after about 2 months, it's okay, it's stale now, really. Mm. We have to get rid of it. But everybody was sick of it by then anyways.
Now, you were speaking briefly about portion control, and I have a question about that because this seems like a really scary topic to me. How do you handle portion control for a kid?
As a parent, you want to be aware that different ages of children need different portion sizes. So a toddler, a 2 to 3 year old, is going to need probably a half a portion of what is a Canada's Food Guide portion. So if one portion of, let's say, meat and alternatives is 60 grams, well, they're only going to need 30 grams. That's tiny. They might only need a quarter of a cup of broccoli. I mean, that's tiny. That's like one little thing of broccoli, you know?
So you
want to get them toddler-sized dishes because if you put it on a huge plate, it looks like it looks to you like you're not giving your kid any food and you're starving them. So you want to get them toddler-sized plates so the plates look full, and then gradually as they get older, you can increase the portion sizes.
Okay. I think that's really important because I think, you know, I don't even think I've heard of friends and their kids and all that sort of stuff where unless they're, you know, have done the research, they seem a little not certain about, you know, should they have this much or it's too much or it's not enough. And then I always worry, too, when, you know, certain times you see family members just trying to ply the kid with food and then you're like, they're going to have an eating issue because, you know, this is unhealthy amounts of food you're trying to put them like down their throats.
Well, I think we sorely overestimate, some people sorely overestimate how much their children need. And they also feel because, you know, you're putting a small amount on a big plate, et cetera, it looks like it's nothing. So that's why I say make sure you get smaller plates so it looks to you like you're feeding your child and you're taking care of them. I think that's really important. I'll post it on my website, but Canada's Food Guide has a page where they list all the portion sizes for the different age groups. Become aware of that and become aware of what Canada's Food Guide portions are. I mean, one portion, according to Canada's Food Guide, if passed, is only 125 milliliters. That would be probably the half of an average size fist.
Okay, that's really important. Now, I wanted to ask you this as well, because speaking of portion control and all that sort of stuff, and the area that we've discussed where it's sort of out of your control is at school. So how important is it to pack their lunch and what goes in that lunch and how much of it?
Well, again, depends on their ages, right? How much goes in depends on their age. What we usually suggest to people is start with the idea of using the four food groups. So it's really important to make sure that you're trying to balance off their energy levels. So if we give them a meal that's got way too much carbohydrates, they're going to go to school and they're going to like fall asleep in the afternoon. If we give them a meal that's only got protein and doesn't have any carbs, then that's kind of like putting a big damp log in your fireplace. It doesn't give you much energy either, right?
Mm-hmm.
We all know we eat a big turkey dinner and we just kind of just go sleep somewhere, right?
Yeah.
So I think what's really important at that way, or one good thing to remember, is to look at the four food groups and say, okay, I want to take some food that's going to give them some protein because that's going to help to keep them full a little bit longer and it's going to help keep their energy levels more even. I want to give them some foods from the grains group and some from the vegetable and fruit group. And it'd be great if maybe they could have some cheese or some milk or yogurt to top it off. So now they've had something from all the four food groups. They haven't had too much concentrated sugar, which is not going to really send their energy levels too high. And because they've had a bit of everything, that should carry them through and give them enough energy to the next session. You want to make sure you make a variety as much as you can, choose a different variety of foods. I think that's one of the issues we have with kids. And the one thing I do want to remind parents is that liking foods like, because I've often had clients tell me, well, I have to send my kids hot dogs because that's what they like. Well, hot dogs, liking hot dogs is not a genetic trait. Liking hot dogs is something we introduce to our kids. Liking any kind of food, generally speaking, is what we've introduced to our kids. And so we need to say, look, you know, this is what's going to make up your lunch, and not be introducing so many of those foods to kids and make them understand that those are special occasion foods or once in a while foods. They're not foods you're going to choose every day for lunch. We have to also make sure with our kids, and I think it's really our responsibility, to understand that it's going to take a while for them to develop new tastes. So we can't lose patience with them. Even for an adult, it takes about 30 tries before a new taste becomes really, you know, acceptable and we start to like something.
Wow, 30, 3-0.
Yeah, 3-0.
Wow.
Like every day for a month, you know?
Well,
those of us who give our broccoli to our kid once and they turn up their nose and then we get in this, like, nah, just keep putting it on the table. Keep hoping they'll try some. Season it up different ways. Ask them about texture. Ask them about taste. Because I have a lot of children who are clients and they'll say, well, I like the raw veggies. I don't like the cooked veggies. Or some kids like spice. Other kids don't like spice. Other kids like things that are more softer in texture. So ask those things, because sometimes it's not the taste so much as the texture they're not liking. Other times it's other issues with the food. They don't like the smell. So sometimes, you know, once you know those things, you can change it up a bit and conquer that issue.
Fantastic. Well, Kim, I want to thank you so much for your time this week. And I want to ask you to tell everyone about your book and the fact that it's available now.
Okay, so I'm really proud to say that I have been able to write a book on nutrition and arthritis. It's called The Complete Arthritis Health Diet Guide and Cookbook, and it's available at all the major booksellers, Chapters. It's available in Loblaws. It's even available on Amazon.
Fantastic. Kim, thank you so much, and I look forward to having you on the show again really soon.
Thanks. I'm looking forward to it again.
That's consulting dietitian Kim Airy. Make sure to check out her website, kimairy.com. You can also find out more information about Kim on our website under the contributors tab, kellyalexandershow.com.
Capture your need for sound.
Job hunting can be a long and painful process. It's something that does take time, effort, and lots of luck to find and land that dream job. Sharon Armstrong has 20 years of experience as a human resources consultant, trainer, and career counselor. She's joining us today to talk about getting through that interview process and some of the things you might want to keep an eye out for. Sharon, welcome to the Kelly Alexander Show.
Thank you, Kelly. Happy to be here with you.
Sharon, you know, job interviews can often be really nerve-wracking, and generally speaking, I guess, what are potential employers looking to assess in an interview?
That's a good question. I think mostly they want to know that you have the appropriate targeted skills to do the job they have advertised. They're looking for a link between your skills and their needs. So you need to do as much preparation as you can to learn about the company, about the position, and then what you've done in the past that'll really resonate with them.
So it is important, and I think people really need to get this in their head, that you can't just go in there willy-nilly. Like, you really need to have your information down pat.
Please don't do that, because you are defeating the purpose. You're really sabotaging yourself. So you want to make sure that you have done as much preparation for that interview as you can. You want to really be able to sell yourself effectively. And in order to do that, you need to know as much about that company. But you don't want to lose track of the fact, Kelly, that it's a two-way street. So the organization is determining if you're a good fit, but you're also determining if the job's a match for your skills and interests.
Now, what are some of the most common mistakes that you've seen potential employees say or do during a job interview?
That is a great question. I think many people do not spend the time in the preparation, so they maybe do not look at that website of the company sufficiently to be able to talk about it. They haven't done their due diligence regarding investigating the recruiters. They haven't practiced some common interview questions. They're not prepared to ask questions. They maybe haven't brought extra copies of their resume or their reference list. They didn't get a good night's sleep. They didn't dress appropriately. And they forgot to be polite and professional as soon as they walk in the door, because that's really when it's game on.
Okay. And I'm assuming that, you know, oftentimes if it's a younger person and this is, you know, only their first real time out, or maybe second or third time out at doing this, that they might go in there and sort of act in an inferior type of, I guess, just the way they're carrying themselves. And they can't really act that way. Not that they should come over or come across overconfident, but like you said, they really need to realize that they are bringing something to the table as well, and not to be afraid to ask questions of the company.
I think that's right. You want to be in a state of mind where you are proud of your accomplishments and you can talk about what you've done. You don't want to embellish, but you want to make sure that you have a clear idea of the value you can add. So we're not talking about arrogance, we're talking about confidence. And there's a big difference. But that is your time to shine. That is your time to talk about what it is you've done that, again, will most resonate with that listener, so that they know that you have the skills and abilities to kind of hit the ground running. And if you are a young job seeker, feel good about what you've done, regardless of the environment. If you've done customer service, if you've done problem solving, anything from a fast food place to maybe even projects you've done in school as a team. You know, feel confident about what you've done and what your role was.
How much of an impact does social media play in terms of hiring someone for a job?
Well, it does in many, many ways. I mean, I think you want to be very active on LinkedIn. You want to have a good professional profile. You want to be very careful with your privacy settings on Facebook. You want to be careful of how you brand yourself if you're on Twitter. You want to use all the social media to look for openings. So it's becoming a bigger and bigger important part of a job search, I think.
Can we actually talk for a second about, you know, your private life versus your corporate life with regards to Facebook and Twitter? Because I'm understanding that now some job interviews are asking, you know, potential employees to give up their Facebook password so they can troll around their Facebook page.
Well, there's a real danger there. I mean, I will tell you a funny definition that I heard, the difference between LinkedIn and Facebook. LinkedIn is a professional business cocktail party, and Facebook is a kegger, a beer kegger.
Right.
So you want to kind of keep that in mind. You really want to separate your personal life from your business life. You have no control over what an employer might try to check. You certainly don't have to share that information, but know that people might get onto a page where you've posted pictures, and you want to make sure that, especially at a time, crucial time in your own business development where you are trying to get opportunities and you want to put your best face forward, you want to make sure that there are certain parts of your life that remain very private.
And when it comes to, you know, maybe a potential employer asking for your Facebook password, or, you know, requesting you to be a friend on Facebook, or, you know, wanting to see this, that, and something else from your Twitter account, do you have the right to say no and sort of be actually concerned about it? Because I feel like there is a definite line that's being crossed if they're asking to check out your photos from your Facebook page.
I think there's a line that's being crossed, too. And I think that you know, the applicant is under no obligation to give that. But if you're in the face-to-face situation, it might be a little uncomfortable for the job applicant when asked that. I have a colleague who, whenever she was asked a question that was a little inappropriate, she would say to the interviewer, "That was a trick question, wasn't it?" and kind of smile. I thought it was a hilarious way to kind of diffuse the moment.
Wow, that is good.
Isn't that great?
That is great.
And I think, you know, it also kind of talks about the legal considerations. An employer is only supposed to focus on the applicant's ability to do the job. That's the most important factor in any hiring decision. So employers are barred from considering different things in the hiring process, you know, in the U.S. under the Title VII of the Civil Rights Act.
Will it actually hurt someone's chances of not getting the job if they choose not to answer some of these questions, which, again, we've determined can be invasive?
You know, Kelly, it could, but on the other hand, they might not want to work there.
Right.
I mean, quite honestly, it might be a sign of the type of culture they'd be joining. So, I mean, an employer has to be aware of the type of impression they're leaving when they're asking these type of questions. And I think they, you know, it really is an employer's market these days. And that's a little unfortunate in that people who are interviewing get a little bit of a, kind of this power trip going. It has to be done respectfully, adult to adult.
Joining us on the show is human resources consultant Sharon Armstrong. Make sure to check out her website, SharonArmstrongAndAssociates.com. Now, some recruiters obviously are passing passing this invasive line, and not just sort of Facebook and Twitter. I've also read that they are asking personal questions like, you know, have you been divorced before? How many relationships have you been in? Because apparently this is some sort of gauge to see how stable you are, you know, outside the office. How do you, I guess, handle these invasive questions and know where to draw the line?
Boy, you know, I think you're absolutely right. One of the classes that I teach is behavioral interviewing to managers, and we have a whole legal section. Again, because the only thing they should concentrate on is the ability to do the job. So there needs to be a direct link between their questions and what, in fact, that'll tell them in terms of your ability to do that job. So there are a lot of unlawful questions that are still out and about, you know. Where are you from? Are you divorced? How many kids do you have? Do you plan on having kids? Totally inappropriate. So again, in the moment, the applicant has to make a decision as to whether to answer that or not. If it doesn't matter to them, they might answer it. If it's appalling to them, they don't have to answer it. It's really a bit of a low risk for an employer because it's rare that they would get in trouble for doing that. But it really does point to a lack of knowledge or education on the part of the employer in terms of what's appropriate in the workplace.
What is your take on potential employees being asked, you know, for these types of things, like whether it's the Facebook passwords or, you know, again, invasive personal questions? Like, do you think there's any place for it, or they really have, like, it's like above and beyond what they're doing?
I'll be honest, I think it's almost the next frontier because there's so much of this information on all of us out there that it's not unusual for employers to try to get as much information as they can. You know, it's very hard to get references these days because people are so litigious. So, you know, only companies generally will just give name, rank, and serial number, right? They'll just confirm salary and give you very little info. So on the part of the employer, it's hard for them to get information. Again, I think the only information they should be trying to get is that information that will let them know whether the person has the skills and abilities needed to do that particular job. So we're talking about technical skills and interpersonal skills just as they relate to doing whatever that company needs done in that role.
Is there any kind of background check or questions, I guess, that a potential employee, you know, could or should be asking a company before going in for an interview? Because like we talked about off the top, you know, you need to find out if this is a good fit for you as well.
You know, a lot of my career clients will actually try to do their research around colleagues and friends of colleagues who might know that culture of that company. And I think that's really a good step for any applicant to take. When they're doing their research on that website, another piece of research is to find anyone who might know someone there to get a sense of the culture, how they operate, how they treat individuals. I think that's all information that goes into the decision-making for an individual to determine if that's a good environment for them to be successful.
What's your biggest piece of advice to a candidate going after their dream job? Because again, or a job that they really just sort of covet or want, because I think when you have something that you want, sometimes it's really hard for you to stay objective.
Yeah, I agree. I think that you want to really treat it as one of the most important research projects you've ever done. You want to find out all you can, and then you want to really turn the mirror on yourself so that you are able to really identify some key accomplishments that you've had in your past that you can share. And you want to be able to share those in a very concise, yet comprehensive way. So, you know, you think about what employers want generally. They want someone who will solve their problems. They want someone who has a history of cutting costs or being innovative or increasing productivity or motivating others or identifying problems or saving time. Think about the things you've done that you're most proud of, either in school or where you've worked, and how you can translate that skill and provide value to that potential employer.
Is there a difference as to how an interview should be handled if you are, you know, new to the job market or if you've been doing this for 25 years? Like, do you handle yourself differently or is it all the same sort of ballgame?
That's a great question. I think the most important thing in any interview is to listen. And that's the, you know, and nature gave us two ears and one mouth that we may use it proportionately.
Mm-hmm.
It really is true in an interview as the interviewee, because what you're trying to do is to listen very, very carefully to what the interviewer is trying to get from you, and then give the answer and support it with an example. And I think no matter what stage of your career you're in, whether you have 20 years of experience or you're just an entry level, you have experience to talk about. You might have good relevant coursework to talk about. You might have done some internships. You might have done some summer jobs. You might have done some informational interviews. You might have learned things on your own. Those are all very valid and important behaviors that employers would need to know.
Sharon, now you've written some books. Can you tell us about them and also where, you know, we can get our hands on them?
Well, thank you, Kelly. It's always a privilege and an honor for an author to be able to give a two-second talk about their books. I've written four books, three business books, which would probably be of most interest, on two topics. One, my last book is called The Essential Performance Review Handbook, available on Amazon, all about the performance appraisal process from both sides of the desk. The book before that is called The Essential Human Resources Handbook. The Essential Human Resources Handbook, which again is for small organizations that might not have the HR feature in their office, but want to make sure they're doing things with best practices to engage employees and create a great environment.
Fantastic. And people can get these where?
Both of them are available on Amazon.
Oh, fantastic. Okay. Well, Sharon, thank you so much for your time today. I really think that you've just given us some great, you know, advice and input about how to handle ourselves out in the job market, especially, you know, in this day and age.
It was a pleasure, Kelly. Thanks, and good luck to all the listeners in their job seeking.
Awesome. That is human resources consultant Sharon Armstrong. Again, make sure to check her out on her website, SharonArmstrongAndAssociates.com.
KellyAlexanderShow.com.
At this time of year, it's important to stop, look around you, and be thankful for all that you have. But how does gratitude affect us in our day-to-day life? Dr. Giacomo Bono joins us to tell us how gratefulness can lead you to a more happy and healthy life. Dr. Bono has a background in social and developmental psychology and is currently working on a book called Making Grateful Kids, a scientific approach to helping youth thrive. Dr. Bono, welcome to the Kelly Alexander Show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So research has shown that maintaining an attitude of gratitude can actually improve your psychological, emotional, and physical well-being. Can you actually explain how this is a beneficial thing to do?
Yeah, it's one of the most interesting, you know, psychologists are now starting to look at things that we weren't able to explore just 10 years ago, things like, you know, virtuous behaviors. What is a virtuous behavior? And gratitude is unique among the virtues, because it helps improve us within, so psychologically, but also socially. Like, we change other people, and we change our relationships, and even we can change society is what we're starting to find out. So it's a special virtue in that sense, just because of its truly it's truly beneficial. We all know it's beneficial, but the science just continues to surprise us how many benefits it has, you know, down to being perhaps one of the most important behaviors for finding a sense of purpose. So it's not even just immediately beneficial, but even in the long run, you know, it helps us stay engaged to the things that really matter in life, which can be really important, you know, especially during tough times.
Can these benefits actually transfer over to children and teenagers? Because, you know, as you're sort of being a kid and growing, you know, up through teenagehood, I think oftentimes you go through this roller coaster of emotions and you don't even quite know yourself. Is it possible for you to be actually grateful and understand that as a child and as a teenager?
Well, it certainly is. We definitely find, just like adults, there are differences between people no matter what. But we definitely find that the kids and teenagers and children who are more grateful, you know, they have many, there's many characteristics that show they're on a path to a more fulfilling and happy life, and we know that these are things that can be trained. It's really about training how you pay attention to interactions with other people and how you think about your life. I mean, every second of every day is a choice, is often a choice, you know, and we tend to select certain things to focus on. So it's very easy to just focus on the complaints and on things to complain about and things that challenge us, because those are so visible and it's very easy to respond to those things. But on the other hand, when you're having a good mood or when things are going well, we often forget. So it's, you know, so this kind of mindfulness is something that can be easily trained. You know, it's just a question of getting in the habit of it. And maybe even, you know, I think it helps if you have other people who are also trying to be in the habit of it. So if parents and teachers are doing it, children and teens are more likely to do it. And if you have, if it's encouraged, widely, then you may have peers that are doing it.
Can gratitude ever be overdone? Like, can someone ever be too thankful for something? Like meaning they might be overcompensating in this false sense of gratitude?
I think so. You know, and this is an interesting question, because gratitude is one of the interesting sort of psychological characteristics of gratitude, is that, you know, it's based on an attribution that other people are responsible for improving my welfare. But at the same time, it is about finding your strengths. And that's one of the things that we're exploring in our research, how it helps us identify our strengths, how this helps children in a unique way, identifying their strengths. And so there's also that internal attribution. I'm responsible for any successes and improvements in my life. So it's got this double focus. You know, other people are responsible and I'm responsible. So I think that, sometimes, what gratitude is often thought of as something that other people are responsible for. And they might forget that, you know, yes, to a degree, other people help us out, but then you have to sort of take that baton and run with it. And so it's very easy, I think, to, it's an interesting question you asked, to just be overly focused on being, grateful to other people. I think the real magic happens when you process that and say, okay, where do I go from now, and what am I gonna do with this? What have I learned from that? And how can I take that further and just be a better person?
In your research, I'm just wondering who, as people, you find to be the most grateful. Like, is it happy, successful people who are doing well? You know, because I'm wondering, because sometimes it feels like it would be easy to be grateful if you are doing well. But then I know you mentioned before, and I remember doing this myself, where things are going well and you actually forget to be thankful that things are actually going well.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, I think probably one of the biggest characteristics, and it's a characteristic that resilient people have as well. It's a predominant characteristic of resilient people and grateful people, is that you are part of a community, whether it's another person and a relationship, and you are, you know, and there's this sort of reciprocity where they're helping you, and then you are also looking out for ways to help them back, or whether it's a community where you feel like you have something unique to offer and people value your contributions, and you in turn become transformed by this relationship with positive others and positive institutions. So I think probably the biggest thing is when you have that community where you're valued and what you have to offer is considered important, and you see that. And so you're more likely to be confident and really try to use your strengths to make yourself better, but also to help others. You know, so it becomes a win-win for the community and for the individual. But I think that's probably the biggest characteristic right there, of being part of a positive community where you're valued.
Joining us on the Kelly Alexander Show is psychologist Dr. Giacomo Bono, discussing how gratefulness can actually lead to a happy and healthier life. And you can check out more information, makinggratefulkids.com. Do you think it's possible for people to be able to change and to look on the bright side of things? Because I know that both you and I have met, a lot of negative Nellies in our life.
Yeah. Yeah, well, there's some pretty interesting research by this Sonia Lubomirsky. She's a psychologist at UC Riverside, and she has her and her colleagues research. What they found is that happiness is about 40% due to, let's see, what I'm gonna try to get this right. It's basically there's 40% of it is intentional, and 15%, half of it is genetic, and the rest of it is due to circumstances. So, you know, we often think that, oh, if you got bad cards, we can't make a difference. But in truth, what matters more is your willpower and your own intentions rather than the bad cards you get. It's very easy to flip around a bad situation. For example, you might complain that you got a parking spot that's really far away. But at the same time, you know, you could choose to focus on the fact that you have a car, or you have a job, and that you get to go to every day, or that, hey, you know, I'm getting some exercise walking, and what a great place I'm at. This is, you know, and you could focus. There's so many other ways to focus on the daily things that could easily be thought of as complaints or bad cards. And so this intentional part of our happiness, you know, being able to intentionally alter your focus is one of the reasons why gratitude is unique among the virtues. It's one of the most changeable. In other words, it's something you can control if you just remember to do it, or if you get in the habit of doing it. And so it's really, you know, it's something that you can get better at. You're learning to reframe, you know, negative situations is something that that is creative and that we can get better at.
I really think it's interesting what you're saying, because I know that in my own life, you know, several years ago, I would say I wasn't negative, but I think you get into that rut where you're like, oh, I got a parking ticket or whatever. And now I would say in the last year to 18 months, I have really changed. Like, it was a purpose-driven exercise that I did to really realize how fortunate I am in life. And it's weird how you feel so much more at peace when you're grateful.
Yeah, it's true. And the cool thing about it is there's more than just peace there. Yes, you know, people who are going through hardship are able to find peace through gratitude. You know, after 9/11, one of the biggest emotions that we were able to find, and this is by looking at the content of newspaper articles, what people were saying, one of the biggest emotions was gratitude. You know, whenever there's some kind of traumatic event, the people who cope best with it are the ones who find benefit from the situation, no matter how bad or traumatic it was. So, you know, even when, whether it's in good times you find peace, or in difficult times when it might even be more important, you could find peace. But even beyond just finding peace, a cool thing about it is that it also energizes you. You know, when you're grateful, you tap into an energy source, and very much like a muscle. You know, when you go to the gym and you work out, it improves, you know, it might tire you out, but it'll also make you stronger in the long run. Well, in that same way, you know, gratitude is even better, because it doesn't tire you out to feel it. It energizes you, and it makes you better at practicing it. So just being able to try to, you know, I guess, savor the good things that people do for us can also energize us. I mean, it doesn't just help you find peace, it can also energize you, and it gives you motivation to want to do more. And that's precisely, you know, we think, because it is tapping into your strengths. What you're doing is you are, in a sense, tweaking your priorities. You are focusing in on the things that really matter to you, and the payoff is going to be huge. And so not only is it peaceful, a sense of peace that you get, but at the same time, because you're using what you're good at, it's also motivating. You know, it's gonna build that intrinsic motivation. So I think those are some of the things involved in the psychology of gratitude.
What do you actually say to negative Nellies who seem to always look at the glass half empty? Because there's a lot of people out there that's their view.
Yeah, that's, you know, it's certainly hard. It's very, very tough
because it's such a habit. I mean, it's just, you know, just to give you a sense, I mean, we tend to be, you know, be more thorough with our explanations when negative things happen. But we just don't do that kind of thorough explaining when good things happen. So it really seems to be deeply ingrained in human nature. So with that said, you know, it definitely can be difficult for that reason. But what can I say? You know, I think the best thing is if you have somebody who you're close with or who has the permission to say things, you know, personal that you won't be offended by or insulted by, or defensive if they say it. You know, I think one of the best things you can do is help people reframe. You know, it really is a question of being creative. You know, so if somebody complains about a party leaving a big mess, you know, a friend could easily say, well, hey, you know, it's so cool that we were surrounded by our best friends or that we were able to have such a good time. You know, if you hear somebody complain about taxes, a neighbor could, you know, very easily turn the table and say, hey, you know, that's great, though, that you're employed. A lot of less fortunate people in the neighborhood. You know, the wife that complains about the clothes, you know, the big pile of laundry that needs to be done. You know, it shows that you have loved ones who are nearby, you know, and you can go on and on. You know, you can complain about chores. The kids can complain about chores and projects, and you know, you can point out, like my son did. You know, my 7-year-old son did, like about 6 months ago. You know, he had a friend of his who had to leave the school because their family had medical bills and they couldn't afford to stay in the neighborhood. You know, so he complained about chores, and I said, hey, isn't it great that we have a home and that we get to stay in this community? What about your friend who has to leave? Isn't that sad? So, you know, it's very the burden, I think, is not so heavy when you have other people who are also helping us reframe negative Nelly kinds of situations.
What's your advice to someone who is trying to lead, you know, a healthy, happy, and positive life? Like, how do they actually stay on track? Is it, like you said, doing the exercises?
Yeah, I think, you know, I think one of the easiest things is to start small, you know, and so when you start small, you have the advantage of being able to accomplish it. And so once you've accomplished it, then you feel, you know, you gain that momentum. And I think it's motivating to get, you know, to get things done. So, you know, when you start with small things, it really is the best way to go. Start small. And you might have little reminders. I mean, gratitude is really about mindfulness. So little notes of people to thank. You know, having thank you cards at home, ready to be used. The more you can put it, the more structure you can put in place, like reminders, or little, you know, maybe even pictures of things that you are grateful for in your life. You know, put those up on your wall. The more you can put these reminders up, the more likely you're going to be prompted to do it, because it's really very easy to just forget. So starting small and having reminders are a couple of things.
And then, like you said, I guess you build upon it.
Yeah. Yeah. And the more you do that, you know, I think the more, the easier it is to then do it when it really counts, you know, for the moments when somebody really goes out of their way, or when, you know, somebody heard something you said months ago and then bought you that exact gift that you've always, you know, that you mentioned you wanted. You know, the surprise, you're more likely to be grateful, you know, when somebody gives you that special gift or for those extraordinary moments.
Fantastic. Dr. Bono, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
It's my pleasure.
That's Dr. Giacomo Bono. Again, make sure to check him out, makinggratefulkids.com.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
As always, a big thank you going out to my guests this week, Kim Airy, Sharon Armstrong, and Dr. Giacomo Bono. I want to leave you with your thought-provoking quote of the week, this time from Marilyn Gray. Life is not a dress rehearsal. Stop practicing what you're going to do and just go do it. In one bold stroke, you can transform today. Now, next week on the show, very exciting, we're talking about the Movember campaign and how this year they're not only talking about prostate cancer, but incorporating men's mental health into their initiative. It's very fascinating. Can't wait for you to join us. Also, don't forget to follow us on Twitter at @KAlexandershow and make sure you check out all of our interviews online on our YouTube channel, as well as our celebrity interviews, youtube.com/KellyAlexandershow. Have a great week. You and I'll chat soon. As always, a big thank you going out to my guests this week, Kim Airy, Sharon Armstrong, and Dr. Giacomo Bono. I want to leave you with your thought-provoking quote of the week, this time from Marilyn Gray. Life is not a dress rehearsal. Stop practicing what you're going to do and just go do it. In one bold stroke, you can transform today. Now, next week on the show, very exciting, we're talking about the Movember campaign and how this year they're not only talking about prostate cancer, but incorporating men's mental health into their initiative. It's very fascinating. Can't wait for you to join us. Also, don't forget to follow us on Twitter at @KAlexandershow and make sure you check out all of our interviews online on our YouTube channel, as well as our celebrity interviews, youtube.com/KellyAlexandershow. Have a great week. You and I'll chat soon.